Welcome to the Angry Admin Podcast for March 12, 2007, episode 19.
Hey everybody, welcome back. This is the Angry Admins Podcast. My name is Joe Bibby.
And they call me Ryan Necessary.
On this podcast, we talk about technology in the workplace, gadgets at home, and basically just where we think information technology is headed. So let's get started on that. Ryan, you've got the first story this week.
Okay, there's a story on ABC News, your number one leader for internet news. Oh, wait, no, they're not. But ABCnews.com reported on the company U.S. Cellular, and they are trying to start a trend of no email Fridays, which I think is pretty cool. So basically, there got to be just so much email at this company that no one could get anything done, and the CEO was having like 200 emails a day, and so he got sick of it and pretty much just put a ban on sending any emails on Fridays and said, pick up the phone, walk down the hall, do what you need to do, meet face-to-face for a change. So, of course, there was a huge backlash to this, and they said some people would just wait until, like, midnight, and they would, like, draft a bunch of emails and then, like, spam them all out at the same time.
That's funny.
But eventually, it went over most of the office, and people found out that, you know, they were just a few doors down from people that they thought were, like, across the country or, you know, sometimes, like, this one lady, her name was Tyler, and people always would address, you know, dear sir, you know, they didn't realize it was a lady. So... long story short, people started enjoying it and being glad that they didn't have so much email, and that there were some positive, you know, outcomes to this, that people started developing closer business relationships and communicating better, and they weren't using email as much to kind of put off work.
Right.
I guess you're familiar with have you ever heard of rolled calls, like rolling your calls?
No.
There was a thing about this on NPR. I guess last weekend I was listening to something and on the radio, and they're talking about rolling your calls. And what it is when somebody needs something from you, what you do is you wait until you know they're not at work or they're there at lunch. And then that's when you call them back and go, hey, Bill, yeah, I was going to get back to you, but what was that you wanted? Anyway, call me back. And then now it's back in their court.
Yeah.
So it's like, hey, I called you back.
Yeah.
So that's rolling your calls. So a lot of people do that with email.
Mm-hmm.
You email people back when you know they're about to leave for a trip or... when they're gone for the weekend, and there's always this give and take of, well, I'll just put it back in their court, or I'll ask them some stupid question about it. But you know, meeting face to face tends to cut a lot of that out. So I don't know. The next thing they're going to try is no meeting Fridays, and I would really be in favor of having no meetings like
that. How
at
about
all.
Just no work Fridays? I mean, come on, let's just do that.
Yeah. What else we got to do?
So another interesting story this week. I guess this isn't really much of a news story as it is just kind of a discovery of a little flaw in Vista, and it's really just inherent to 32-bit Vista, but that's really what everybody has to use. Basically, it's a problem with memory, and this really reminds me of back in the DOS days where we had to use HiMem, which that'll make sense in a second. Basically, 32-bit operating systems can only support 4 gigs of RAM. Now, most people hear that and they think, oh, that's fine. 4 gigs is plenty for now. And, you know, by the time I can use all that, I'll be moving on to 64-bit Vista or something else. But what that actually means is 4 gig total. So that includes video card and L1 and L2 cache. So if you think about that, if you have a 1 gig video card, which is becoming more and more of the norm,
right?
And then, say, 512 megs of – or I guess it's 512K of L2 cache, but, you know, a meg or 2 megs of L2 cache – that kind of takes away from your main system memory. So your operating system can only use, you know, say 3 gigs of your RAM that you have installed, and you're wasting the rest of it.
Right.
Now, there are some ways around this that they have built in. One of those is called PAE, and basically just kind of extends your RAM into the space, which can cause some problems, and is very similar to the HiMem days. And that, I mean, I don't think anybody wants to go back to that.
No.
So this is just one of those things where, you know, really Microsoft probably should have taken this opportunity to push everybody to 64-bit, or at least built in 64-bit code support in the 32-bit version of Vista.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the method that Apple has taken, but you know, it's not really fair to compare because Apple doesn't have to worry as much about backward compatibility as Microsoft does.
Well, it's bizarre too because they did all this work on trying to get ready for the hybrid hard drives,
right?
That have the cache, mm-hmm. and then they did all this other stuff about the Ready Boost, where oh yeah, plug in your thumb drive and it makes we use the RAM on your thumb drive to make your system faster,
right?
And then you know the main system RAM isn't even being used effectively.
Yeah, I think. I want to say that they really were pushing for 64-bit Vista back when, you know, it was getting closer to being rolled out. And I think they just too many companies didn't want to rewrite all their software for 64-bit OS. So this is kind of like this is Microsoft's problem. You know, they're stuck with they want to support all these companies and make sure that they meet all their needs, which is opposite of Apple, who's like, we know better than you, and this is what you're going to do. So you know, that's kind of both sides of the same camp. And it's really this is one of those cases where it burns Microsoft and Apple is looking like the smart one, whereas in other cases, you know, it looks like Apple's being a snob. This time, it doesn't really work out for them.
Well, I've had business customers, users ask me, "Hey, should we get 64-bit machines?" And I'm never in a hurry to tell them, "Yeah, go ahead and go for it," you know, because it's like, man, do you want to dive off into that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, and so yeah, I mean, if you go 64-bit, you need a 64-bit chip, which I think at this point all of the AMD chips do both.
Right.
And I believe Intel has also followed the lead on that where it's kind of a dual mode version.
Right.
So that's the nice thing is the hardware support is basically there. You probably will lose some cards and some of your accessories and things. But either way,
yeah,
that's just kind of where it is right now. And so watch out for that on your system.
Yeah. So if you built a brand new awesome machine, you know, for Vista – and you have all this RAM in it, then maybe it's not even taking advantage of all of it.
Yeah, so I'm looking pretty smart with my 2 gig.
And if I recall, on last week's show, or maybe the week before, you were talking about some guy had done some testing,
mm-hmm.
and he figured out that the optimal amount of RAM for Vista was...
4 gig.
4 gig.
Yeah, so there's like...
you can't even hit the sweet spot.
Yeah, and maybe that's part of it, too, is it, you know, maybe it is like 3.5 gig is the sweet spot, but you can't really put that in, so...
Right.
Yeah. 4 gig is where you had to be. I don't know. That's very, very odd.
Weird. Come on, Microsoft. Stop sucking.
Yeah, come on.
So there was a rumor, and I hate to propagate rumors unless I'm the one that thought of it, but over on iCringely, it was just a little bit too interesting, so I have to, you know, quickly dive into it. So they're talking about Apple, and they're talking about basically the whole idea of the video decoder chip.
Mm-hmm.
And then so, like, if you go to even, like, the grocery store or, like, Stop and Go, you can get a DVD player for, like, $35.
Hmm.
And it's just a cheap piece of junk, but it will play any DVD great.
Right.
But if you want to play a DVD on your computer, you got to have a pretty hoss computer,
mm-hmm.
you know, a PC with like nice video card, lots of RAM, a decent processor to watch a movie. Now, what's the difference? Well, chances are your PC is having to decode that video in software.
Right.
And that cheap player that you bought at the supermarket is doing it in hardware.
Right.
So they're theorizing, and I'm not exactly sure what led to the rumor, but the theory is that they're going to put a hardware chip into all Apple products that will let it do this decoding. Now, the thing is, it probably will do MPEG-2 decoding, but for sure it's going to be doing H.264.
Wow.
Which is, you know, like the superior codec right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the MPEG, the hottest MPEG-4 codecs out there.
Now, this chip is, you know, like an MPEG-2 decoder chip, they say, is like $7 on mm-hmm. average. The H.264 chip is about around $50.
Wow, so that's not cheap.
Yeah, so, you know, in the article, you know, they talk a little bit about, you know, well, why don't we already have this on all computers? And they say, well, you know, maybe it's an excuse to sell a faster computer because you're shopping for a laptop and you use
right.
that. Oh, excuse me, sir. Did you want to watch movies on your laptop? Well, of course, Johnny. Okay, well, you need to have, you know, this Uber 3 gigahertz if you really want to watch DVDs because it doesn't have this hardware decoder. But they're also saying that not only will it decode H.264, but this chip that they're going to include in everything will encode H.264. So imagine even the $699 Mac Mini being better than your TiVo Series 2.
So, yeah, so it could take a live video feed in and code it on the fly.
And it would be doing it without using the processor that you're using for everything else in your system. So you're like doing better than your TiVo on a tiny little box while you're multitasking other things with your main system CPU chip and RAM. So that's amazing.
So my question is, why doesn't the Apple TV do this?
Well, maybe one day it will.
Maybe it's a software update they're going to release later or something.
Well, the thing is that if it is truly a chip, then it will have to be, it'll be part of the hardware.
Right. So it'd have to be already, the hardware chip would have to already be on the Apple TV. Maybe they'll release like the Apple TV DVR edition or something.
Or maybe you'll pay $50 and you'll download a firmware patch that will turn it on.
Yeah, I can see that maybe.
Something like that.
I don't know. I mean, it seems like it's a good idea, and I can see why maybe somebody would think this. I mean, this guy, Cringely, is, you know, he's sometimes he's out there on his rumors, but usually a lot of what he says makes sense, and I could really see this working. Having a H.264, you know, a small hard drive would go a lot further because it's an encode high quality.
Right.
Interesting.
So that'll be something to watch to see if it comes out. Now, I think it will cost, they're saying that in the long run, it will cost Apple money because pretty much if you put this chip in everything, then that means you don't have to sell as fast of computers to watch video. And, you know, everything between YouTube and Google Video and all these little small clips and everything and throwing television shows around for sale on iTunes, this is all becoming like the norm now.
Well, and watching video is becoming such a high demand thing. And if you can make your system feel faster at playing back video, you'll sell more PCs.
Right.
You'll sell more Apples.
And this would also position Apple to be the number one again at producing video, encoding video, cutting video. So it's like, oh, you're doing some video? What? You don't have a Mac? What, are you nuts?
Well, that's one of the big complaints. I mean, I hear it over and over about H.264 is that it just takes forever to encode to it.
Right.
Because it is such a high process, you know, it's a high demand process. And if you had a chip dedicated to that, I don't know.
Yeah, because like the video systems we've messed with, like we had an old Pinnacle video editing box at work. And, you know, it had a hardware MPEG-2 encoder. And it would rip through, you know, video.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, when you start trying to encode MPEG-2 in software, man, you must as well go to lunch because it's just going to take a while. Yeah. So this is interesting. We'll see what happens.
I'm looking forward to it. Hopefully that does come true.
Yeah, that'll be good for Apple in the long run. The other thing I saw this week was they were talking about in February there was another attack on the root DNS servers. Distributed denial of service attack. So this happened back in 2002. I don't know if you remember. It may not have gotten much press back then, but anyway, apparently it came from like the Pacific region of Asia, and it was an attack against some of the root DNS servers. And of course, these guys are run by ICANN, which is the guys that pretty much tie domain names to the actual IP addresses.
Yeah. So I guess the root DNS servers are pretty important, right? I mean, this is a big deal if they get taken down.
Right. That means pretty much the internet stops, grinds to a halt.
Gotcha.
Unless you memorize the IP addresses for everything you care about.
Oh, you don't do that?
Well, yeah, of course I do. But, you know, I was actually thinking that we need to put together some sort of a little application that every week it takes like your top 20 websites that you surf and it writes like a local Etsy host list for that on your PC so that if your DNS goes down, then you're still okay for most of the things that you surf.
That would be nice.
So go ahead and get started on that, Joe, and let me know how that turns out, because I'm too lazy.
So this is kind of a side topic, but it's related. Have you heard of, what's it called? OpenDNS? Have you heard about that? That seems like a really good idea, but it doesn't seem like it ever really works. I've tried it, and it always seems like it's been slow.
Yeah, and for the listeners, do you want to, like, just...
So basically, OpenDNS is like a free-to-use DNS service.
Right.
So you add this to your DNS list so that if your IP, your ISP's DNS goes down, you're still good to go.
Right.
But I've heard other people talking about it, and I've heard decent things about it, but it seems like it's really not ready to be your main DNS. Maybe if you added like your third entry or something.
I've tried it before, and it was a little slow.
Yeah.
Maybe even more than a little.
Yeah. Okay.
But as a last resort, sure, throw it in there. But so back to the attack on the root DNS servers. Yes, it's very bad. We do not want this to succeed. And apparently what the root server owners are doing now is there's this new thing called Anycast, and it's a load balancing software. And what it does is it basically just says, instead of like passing traffic on to, you know, all of the mirrors. It just passes the traffic on to the nearest mirror. So if I'm in Asia and I launch this distributed denial of service attack against, say, you know, like the .com root servers or whatever. Now, of course, that is copied all over the world in, like, I think like 12 different locations. So all over the world, if you have this big zombie fleet of infected machines, which suddenly obey your commands and start trying to attack this, all of those attacks only get as far as the nearest .com mirror to them.
Okay.
So it cannot be passed on and coordinated. And that's where the power of distributed denial of service is that they all hit one thing at the same time.
Right.
You know, I mean, if somebody sticks me with a paperclip, yeah, it hurts. But if 10,000 people do it at the same time, I'm dead. You know, so this apparently was put into place. And I think out of the servers that were attacked, only two were affected. And those didn't have Anycast install. So
it was effective.
Yeah, they're kind of, I don't know if they should be bragging, but they kind of bragged that, you know, hey, we were attacked, we stood up to it, it was no big deal. And the two servers that went down, they're probably going to be upgraded to Anycast pretty soon. So,
wow, that's great.
It was interesting, good news for this because, you know, the whole zombie fleet, the denial of service and the, you know, the spam and these guys that do this stuff, they're just getting way out of hand and it just seems like there's nothing you can do to stop it. So I think the more technology that gets invented to just pretty much just negate it, you know, just make it, you know, nullified, you know, because of the way that the architecture is, then I think that's the way to go. That's the only way you're going to be able to beat it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the whole root DNS server concept has always kind of been, in my mind, the dirty little secret of the internet. Because it's always like, oh, the internet, it's this web of, you know, no matter where you are, it'll fix itself and reroute. But that's not really true.
Right.
I mean, to a point it is, but it sounds like this Anycast really kind of takes the internet to the level of where the average citizen thought of it. It's that's very cool. That's a really good development, I think.
Right. And even if say like the .com mirror that's closest to you gets totally taken down, well, it's only in your region that it's down.
Right. It's not taking down.
If you call someone in France and say, "Hey, Jean-Pierre, is your internet working?" "Oh yeah, mine's fine." You know, versus, you know, in the other model, you know, where we were in O2, it's like the whole world stops.
Yeah.
You know, and that's,
yeah,
that's not where we want
to
be.
It shouldn't be that simple to take down the entire internet.
Right. So I don't know. I thought this was pretty cool.
Very. This week we wanted to cover a kind of a hot topic recently on the internets. It's a function called OpenID. This has really gained some traction recently because big companies like AOL have started to actually support it, along with Dig.com has mentioned that they will have this in place by the end of the year. And what OpenID is, it solves the problem where, say, I want to go to Dig and I have to have a username there. Then I want to go to, say, the Angry Admins forums and I create a username there. And then I want to go to avsforums.com and create a username there. So you have all these different usernames and, you know, maybe you don't want to use the same password everywhere because you're worried about somebody getting your password and getting in there and posting for you. And, you know, it's really kind of everybody has a login anymore because you want to be able to track, you know, all these social news sites, you want to track what you're doing and make it, you know, more social and more interactive. Or say you want to leave a comment on somebody's blog. Well, nobody wants to remember all these usernames and all these passwords, and you don't want to write them all down. It's really not what you want to do. So this company came along and created what's called OpenID. Now, the idea behind this is to kind of use a universal login for all these sites. Now, at first, when I first heard about this, I wasn't on board. I didn't think it was a good idea. And actually, really, before I started researching this, you know, I had imagined we'd be coming on and talking about this and really saying, you know, don't do it, don't use it. But the more I looked into it, the more I realized that it really is a brilliant idea. So let me explain a little bit more what you do. You can run a server yourself. So if you have a server that you have pretty good access to, you set up an OpenID server, and then you can generate your own login control, or you go to one of the many already existing servers. One of those is myopenid.com. So you go there and you set up an OpenID. So, for example, angryadmins.myopenid.com, and that's kind of how all the IDs look. It's actually a URL that you use for your ID.
Gotcha.
So you create a username, you create a password, and then you go, when you go to another site that supports OpenID login, you'll go there. So an example is LiveJournal is one of the big supporters right now that has it really integrated well. You see your normal login and password boxes, and then the right next to that, there's a Use OpenID account. Hmm. So you click that. You type in your OpenID URL. So as in our example, angryadmins.myopenid.com. Then LiveJournal checks with the myopenid.com servers to see if they are on your approved list. If they are, you're automatically logged in, and that's your kind of your username now for LiveJournal. If you haven't added them to your approval list, it will bump you to myopenid.com and ask if you want to allow once, always allow, or deny. If you deny, it bumps you back to LiveJournal, and you just see the login screen again.
Right.
If you say allow once, lets you in, and every time it bumps you through this whole process of allow, deny, always allow. And if you always allow, then every time you type in that URL, you're bumped in right away.
Mm-hmm.
So, sounds pretty good, right? Now, there are some issues with it. There could be spammers could create a spammer OpenID server. Now, would that really be that much of a problem? Not really, because you'd have to create your ID on that server for it to really be able to do anything.
Right.
So, you know, we were saying this before, it doesn't protect morons, right? I mean, but you can't create software to protect a moron. I mean, you just have to be at least somewhat intelligent. So don't go to spamme.com and create an open ID and use that everywhere.
Yes, please.
The other kind of problem I see with this, you know, one, it's good because it's decentralized. You don't have to use myopenid.com. There's, I think on the list I saw, there were 20 or 30 servers, and probably 20 are added every day.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is, how do you know which one to use? And then when you pick one, generally it's because somebody else is recommending it.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people are probably going to be using the same server.
Right.
So if that server gets hacked, then they can get to all of your logins still.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still a little bit of a problem. It is kind of centralized in that, you know, right now the big recommended one is myopenid.com. We're recommending it. You know, it's the top one on the list. So if everybody uses myopenid.com, well, if myopenid.com gets hacked, they could get to all those IDs, and then you'd be kind of hosed.
Yeah.
So based on that, you know, obviously you wouldn't use this for banking. You wouldn't use this for pretty sensitive things. You know, your tax return, login, you wouldn't create with this. Student loans, that kind of thing.
Right.
But I think it really does make sense on a lot of fronts.
Well, I think a lot of the web activity now is I think a lot of folks spend the majority of their day doing things like looking at news sites.
Mm-hmm.
Let me rephrase that. They spend a majority of their surfing time
Right. Looking
at blogs, message boards, news sites, and a lot of these places want you to log in.
Right.
I know. There's a lot of times when, you know, it's like, to read more of this story, please create an account. Well, no thanks, bye. You know, I mean, my curiosity doesn't go very far, you know, so
yeah.
I'm not creating a login. And it's not so much that I don't want to get to the content, I'm just afraid I'm going to be spammed.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't want to sign up for another thing and have another password out there. And this prevents all that. The other thing it does is, I guess, it keeps these sites from having to manage, you know, more usernames and passwords on their own. Their own servers.
Well, and you don't have to enter personal information. You know, every
right.
time you create a login, you're at least giving your email address, if
yeah.
not more.
Right. How old are you? Where are you?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and, you know, yeah, it's nice for them to see those demographics, but it doesn't force the user to have to enter personal information just to see one story that they're never going to go back and look at ever again.
Right. I could definitely see myself using this over BugMeNot.
Yeah. Yeah. If BugMeNot, which So if people don't know what that is, what is BugMeNot?
Okay, so BugMeNot is a very small Firefox browser extension that pretty much, if you have logins that are in a big database, say everybody that has BugMeNot or whatever, it just pulls from a database. And if you go somewhere like, say, NewYorkTimes.com, and they want you to log in to read a story, well, you just right-click on the field and just say, log in with BugMeNot. Mm-hmm. And BugMeNot just starts hammering it with known usernames and passwords that people have shared until it gets in. Don't get me wrong. I've put some mileage on BugMeNot. But, you know, compared to that, this, I think, is a much better way to do it. And you're not, perpetrating that you're someone else, you know, which probably violates every terms of use for every website that was ever created.
Yeah, I mean, it, the idea of just having one login for pretty much everywhere I casually go, that's just so refreshing to think about. So there's another problem that we haven't talked about yet, and that is that websites have to start using it.
Right.
And right now, from what I could gather, it's really easy to get a login. There's lots of websites to go to create a login. So there's a lot of providers, but not a lot of sites are using it yet. And, you know, we want to add it to our forums, but the forum backend we're using doesn't have support for it yet. So, you know, we can't add it even though we want to. And it's just kind of still starting to build momentum. And then there's another issue. So WordPress.com, they support it. Oh, yeah, we support OpenID. Well, not really. They support in that when you create a WordPress.com account, that can be used as an OpenID. But I can't go to WordPress.com with my OpenID.com OpenID and log into WordPress.
Right.
So that doesn't help me.
Right. You can't just go halfway.
So if everybody does that, then we're just back to where we started.
Yeah. Well, hopefully more people will start to adopt it because I do think it's a good idea. I would love to have something like this for all my general browsing.
Oh, yeah.
And I really would kill for something like this on a common game account.
Ooh, I could see that.
So imagine
kind of like go ahead.
I was just going to say, imagine like all the games you play, if they require a login, having like a centralized ID, so and being able to manage all your subscriptions from there.
Yeah, yeah.
Because everything I play is $12-14 a month. Good grief. But it's always this. Oh well, that was that password for that game.
Right.
This is this password for this game, and you know, it's just you have to manage it per game. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a pain. And so if I had one thing that managed all my game accounts and then one thing for banking and maybe one more thing just for surfing, I could probably wrap my head around that.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, I just realized this as you were talking about gaming, but this is really what Microsoft tried to do with their Passport login. And they tried to get everybody to use this Microsoft login for everything. But the problem with that was it was closed. You know, OpenID is actually what it sounds like, OpenID. It's open source. We didn't mention that yet.
Right.
But you can see the code that it uses. And, you know, it's free for anybody to set up a server as long as you have the server to do it. Go for it. You know, they'll let you go ahead and do it. So that's what's really nice about this is it's not owned by one person. And, and in that sense, it's also decentralized. And that's really nice.
Yeah, I like it. It's strong encryption when it does do it, and it's, like I say, open source, so no one's making any money off of it. So
I think probably, you know, if one of two companies takes this, if either Microsoft decides to do it, which chances of that happening are 0%, or Google. If Google adopted OpenID, I think this would really pick up some speed if they started running this on all their servers so that I could use my Google.com account anywhere. I could see that being really useful.
What I'm afraid of is that someone like Google will adopt it, and then someone like Yahoo, a big competitor, will say, oh, quick, we need to invent our own.
Yeah.
And then try to get all of their built-in like DSL subscribers and Yahoo members to like try to jump onto theirs, which isn't compatible.
Right. Well, and that's really what happened with the Microsoft thing is nobody wanted to use Microsoft's. And the only – I think I could see Google maybe doing this just because they are very open source friendly and, you know, they let people tie into their things.
Right.
But they already have all their login stuff created, so it would be a major overhaul for them to do it. So chances of that are pretty low also, I think.
That's cool. I like that.
Yeah, so go create an OpenID, log into some sites, see what you think, and post on the forum, see what your experiences are. Well, that's the show for this week. We want to thank everybody for tuning in again to our – friendly little podcast here. please go check out our website, angryadmins.com. We will have the show notes up there, so if you want to follow a link or look into any of these stories a little bit more, that's the place to do it. Also, if you have anything you want to let us know about the stories we have posted, go to the forums and leave us some comments there. You can tell us what you hated, what you liked, what you didn't like, what you want us to talk about more, or if we are just totally fired. So until next time, I'm Joe Bibby.
And I'm Ryan Necessary.
Stay angry.